This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Today on the show, Fiji's remote communities have started voting in the national election a week earlier than everyone else. That's because getting ballot papers to them can mean officials are travelling for hours, sometimes on foot or horseback, through mountains, forests and rivers.
And you have to cross that river 25 times. Sometimes it's waist deep, sometimes it's knee deep.
And it's being hailed as a success. But can the Climate Change Loss and Damage Fund, signed off by the United Nations recently, actually make an impact? The UN's regional head says she's optimistic, but...
A big test of this commitment that we heard at COP27 is indeed to see how quickly this fund can get off the ground.
All that and more today on the show. I'm Priyanka Srinivasan. So glad to have your company. First, though, while the global population has hit 8 billion, a spat has broken out about the population of Papua New Guinea. A study from the United Nations suggests PNG's population could be almost double the official estimate. As Angus Randall reports, the findings are so controversial, the PNG government doesn't want them released to the public.
It's Australia's closest neighbour, but we have no idea just how big it really is. Papua New Guinea had an estimated population of over 9 million, but research from the United Nations could see that increased to 17 million. Paul Barker is the executive director of the Institute of National Affairs in Port Moresby. He's surprised to see the figures jump so high.
Many of us felt that the figures that were coming from the national census in 2011 were probably an underestimation of the figure. But certainly, I don't think many were envisaging a figure coming up to 17 million, that's for sure.
There was a census due last year, but it was delayed due to the pandemic. It's expected to take place next year. In the meantime, the UN Population Fund study was paid for by the Australian government. It used satellite modelling and housing surveys to reach that figure of 17 million. Paul Barker says it may fill some gaps left by the last census in 2011.
Obviously, it's not a census, but to some extent, it may be picking up some details of population that weren't available from the census process itself, because sometimes you do need, when you're doing a census, to do village mapping. There wasn't that, wasn't village mapping done for the 2011 census. There was for 2000. But, you know, populations are moving in PNG. Even whole communities are shifting, new centres are developing.
If the 17 million figure is accurate, it will see Papua New Guinea tumble down the global economy rankings and could impact how much aid Australia sends to PNG.
Well, it will certainly push the per capita income well down, certainly take it out of the lower to middle income category and push it well down into the low income category of countries.
There are considerable doubts over whether the study is accurate. PNG Prime Minister James Marape told the Australian newspaper he estimated the population could be around 10 million, but he admits he may be wrong. The PNG government has refused to publish the findings, so no one knows exactly how that United Nations figure was reached. Professor Stephen Howes is the director of the Development Policy Centre at the Australian National University.
You know, we do know it used some satellite modelling. But how reliable it is, you know, you really can't be commented on until at least a summary of the report has been released.
Professor Howes says it's difficult to get a true sense of the population. There are many remote communities, and the National Statistics Office, which conducts the census, has its own governance issues. He's holding out for the next census before making a call on just how many people live in PNG.
It is very speculative. The first step would be to release the report. But even then, I think what's really crucial and where the Australian government should be focusing its effort is on the two governments working together to ensure that the 2023 census does give us a reliable estimate of the PNG population. I mean, every country uses a census to get that reliable estimate. You know, there really is no alternative to that. And so I think that should be the priority in the coming year.
Australian aid to PNG stands at around $600 million this year.
That was Angus Randall with that report. And the study in question, as we mentioned, was reported, was reportedly funded by the Australian government. Pacific Beat put a list of questions to that government. A Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade's spokesperson responded by saying the UN Population Fund's work related to PNG's population is a matter for the UN Population Fund and the government of Papua New Guinea. We have also invited Papua New Guinea's Prime Minister, James Marape, onto the show here on Pacific Beat. We hope he will join us soon to share his thoughts on the study. And now, to help us get to the bottom of PNG's true population size, joining me now is FDC Pacific Fellow at the Lowy Institute, Maholupa Laville. Good morning to you, Maho.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Now, very interesting here, 17 million, as we've heard, that's the new estimate by the UN Population Fund of PNG's population. But I understand you're a bit skeptical of that figure. What are your thoughts?
Yes, I am skeptical. And just like the earlier guests that you had, Paul Bach and Professor Stephen House, I think we really need to get our hands on the study. And I was cited in the Australian article. And I asked for the article, and the author didn't have it anyway. We really have to see the methodology, and it seems that satellite doesn't work in countries like PNG, just because PNG has 96 districts. 91 of those districts are rural, and so counting, for example, night lights or roofs of houses when the household are not credible and are used in, say, the 2011 census that was incredible.
Yes, so it sounds like, Maho, you haven't seen that study, and as you mentioned, it does use satellite imagery. I mean, we're hearing that the 17 million figure is almost double. You know, we understand that it's at about around 9 million that we that the previous estimate was for Papua New Guinea's population. I mean, are some of the questions just how do you hide this many people? How is it unknown that the population is so high? Do you think the actual population is closer to the previously known 9 million mark?
So the PNG government and other think tanks that work on PNG have done credible studies that place PNG's population about 9 to 11 million. If the population was as high as 17 million, we would see that pressure in other things like overload in hospital patients, overload in schools, and we're not seeing that. So again, if we have the study, the report, then we'd be able to make an informed comment. But at this moment, it seems a little far-fetched.
I mean, is this a question around the media reporting on this study that it sounds like it hasn't been widely available? Do you think some questions should be asked there as well?
Yes and no. A lot of the problems cited in the Australian article are problems that PNG has faced with. Now, it doesn't matter if the population is 17 million or the population is 11 million or the population is 9 million. We see that service delivery is pretty poor. We see that the borders to the east with Solomon Islands for PNG and to the west with Indonesia is very porous, and people are illegally migrating, and our government doesn't have the numbers for that. And again, our chief statistical office, the National Statistics Office, like you reported earlier, has its own governance issues. So there's a lot of questions with the current estimates that government has. And so, again, like Professor Stephen House said, PNG urgently needs a census, and its PNG's development partners should support government's plan to carry out a 2024 census.
And is there another aspect? I mean, we just recently had the elections in Papua New Guinea. We see good turnouts, high turnouts in PNG elections, along with other issues that we also see, including violence and instability during that time. But if the fact is that the population size is unknown or much bigger than previously known, that could put a question around the strength of Papua New Guinea's democracy and elected governments as well, no?
It is. And A lot of the problems with the elections that we had this year and then the elections in 2017 and the ones before that was that the electoral roll wasn't updated properly. And it was inflated by some estimates, particularly for the previous electoral rolls. And then in this election, it was abandoned. And because it wasn't updated, there were estimates that about 1 million voters were disenfranchised. Mm-hmm. Now, if we have a credible census, that can be used to actually assess the integrity of the roll. And because the roll is faulty and then we have a census that is faulty, we really don't know indicators like the voter turnout or voter participation. And it stands to question if government is deliberately manipulating or at least delaying the census because it doesn't want a credible estimate of how much it's manipulated the election system, or if it's just a passive issue of it couldn't run the census during COVID-19. But again, if we have a good census, that should be the focus now, so that we can assess things like democracy and other things like service delivery.
And could that also hint to why we might be seeing that the Papua New Guinean government doesn't want this report published? That's what we've been reporting here on ABC. Why wouldn't the Papua New Guinea government publicize this report?
So at this moment, I am uncertain, but in my opinion, I think government does not trust the credibility of the report. And then it is also very politically sensitive, because if there is a number like 17 million, then previous government estimates of what GDP per capita is, because 17 million, and then you have government's estimates of what 9 million, so 17 million is almost double, which means that indicators for living standards like GDP per capita would halve. And also non-resource GDP, because PNG doesn't have a credible estimate for gross national income. And so the best estimate that we have is non-resource GDP per capita. And that would halve as well, and then bring us lower than the low middle income that we have to a low income country like countries in Southern Africa.
So pretty significant outcomes just from the changing in population size and the estimates there. If you are just tuning in to Pacific Beat, we're speaking to FDC Pacific Fellow at the Lowy Institute, Mahalopa Leville. We're talking about that interesting study. It's been reported in The Australian yesterday about Papua New Guinea's population could be as high as 17 million, according to one United Nations report, which hasn't been circulated. We haven't seen it yet, but we are hearing some skepticism from that report, including from Maho yourself. Now, we've been talking about why Papua New Guinea might not be keen to publicize this study, claiming that 17 million is the population size of Papua New Guinea. But how about on Australia's side? We understand that it funded this report. Why would Australia care how big Papua New Guinea's population is?
Australia has a lot to be... a lot of concern with Papua New Guinea. I mean, Papua New Guinea is Australia's closest neighbor. We border to the northern tip of Australia and up the southern tip of PNG by about 3 kilometers. And so that close, even by sea, if PNG's population drastically increases, that increases its security risk. But also because as Australia's closest neighbor, obviously for geopolitical security reasons, for the region at large, and for just the shared history, the everything else that PNG stands as in its importance to Australia. It's in Australia's best interest that PNG accurately assesses its population, and also the level or extent to which its services are delivered.
And now we understand that there is a census coming up, I believe, in 2024. Do you foresee any problems there? Will we potentially get an accurate number for Papua New Guinea's population during that year, during that census?
So we're all hoping that it's run right. In the 2011 census, again, wasn't done credibly. It was a rushed study by the National Statistics Office. There were a lot of problems around how trained the officials were. the logistics behind it, the funding from the PNG government to the actual census. And so we fear that a lot of those problems haven't been rectified from within the National Statistics Office, and they can possibly be repeated. But again, the National Statistics Office has run a pretty successful demographic and health survey. And even though this wasn't done in a year, it was done from 2016 to 2018. It was done largely by the support of the USAID. And so we believe that if development partners are keen on helping the PNG government run a successful study and they support it from now till the census, I believe that we can run a credible census. That'll be the first census in about over 20 years that we have credible estimates of PNG's population.
Yes, let's hope that that happens, because obviously, as we've been talking about, that population number does matter. Maho, thank you for your time this morning on Pacific Beat.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
And that was Maho Lupa Leville. He is the FDC Pacific Fellow at the Lowen Institute, speaking to us there about that very interesting study on Papua New Guinea's population. You are listening to Pacific Beat here on ABC Radio Australia. Hope you're having a lovely Tuesday morning. The official date for Fiji's election is December 14, but some people in the country's most remote communities are voting a week earlier. This pre-polling is a logistical challenge for electoral officials, forcing them to sometimes travel for hours on horseback or on foot through mountains, forests and rising rivers. ABC reporter Lide Mvono in Suva with this report.
Travelling in sometimes treacherous conditions, electoral officials delivered ballot boxes to almost 80,000 people in more than 600 communities.
We are hoping for good weather. Please pray for good weather. Please pray for the safety of my staff. And we're looking forward to a big turnout on in pre-poll. In the last election, pre-poll turnout was 64%. And that was not acceptable by any means.
Mohamed Sanim is Fiji's supervisor of elections.
This village is 4.5 hours of walk across this one river, and you have to cross that river 25 times. Sometimes it's waist deep, sometimes it's knee deep, because they don't want people crossing the river at night. And 25 times crossing the river is not that you are going, the river is winding and you are going to cross it straight. And the river is has got gravel in it, so the chances that you will cross without falling is zero. So taking materials into these areas is not easy.
In the village of Nasele in Naitasiri province, the first voter to cast her ballot was Philomena Likumoto. She says whoever wins these elections must move the country forward.
In my view, elections should be about getting help to our communities. It was very easy because there were booklets to help me vote. This was the fourth time for me to vote. Leading up to the elections, I was praying to him to help me vote wisely. In my view, these elections should be for good governance and good leaders, so our needs can be met.
Teams were sent to Fiji's outer islands as far as Lau, which is closer to Tonga than to mainland Fiji, and deep into mountainous regions where horses are the main mode of transportation.
Very, very treacherous. So that is the lay of the land, as I must say. Some of the maritime region islands. Onoilau is the last island. It is further from Fiji than the nearest country, right? And you have to go by boat. It takes, I think, 2 days by boat, right? The boat does their briefing before they get on the ship. And then there is daily captain's briefing. And you can't train anybody for a sea voyage. Mostly you can just be prepared for it. And so that's what we're doing. So pre-poll is happening in areas where it is hard to reach. Also where there is no connectivity.
The overall goal is to get more people to vote and improve turnout from the 64% that voted at the last elections. Pre-poll voting is for communities too far away from or too small for a polling station. For Nasele headman Rsikeli Rambakele, he is happy his village was the first to vote.
We were happy that the first pre-poll happened in our village. We prepared well and the FEO was helpful in raising awareness, especially to the elderly. We are happy with the turnout of voters today. We asked them to choose wisely, to choose a government we could all support to lead us in the way forward. I am encouraging voters to do their duty and to vote to choose a government to lead us into the future.
Apart from far-flung communities, provisions have been made for members of the police and army to take part in pre-polling.
That was ABC reporter in Fiji, Uwe Mavono. Hold the front page, though no most of the news we consume is online anyway, but you know what time it is. It's that time to find out what's on the front page, what's on the front of our online papers, I guess. And to do that, I'm joined by reporter Kyle Evans. Good morning, Kyle.
Good morning, Priyanka. One day I'll find out what movie that that little snippet's from. Is it from a movie?
Yeah, I guess it must be, isn't it? Hold the front page. It sounds very familiar, but I'm probably just sounds familiar now because I hear it every day with you here on NewsWrap.
You might be right.
but yes, we will get to the bottom of it. Now, Vanuatu's Deaf Society is pushing for their own national language. Can you tell us more?
Yeah, this is a great story. I wasn't actually aware of this, but at the moment, there is no national sign language in Vanuatu, meaning most people basically have to invent their own ways to communicate over there. So this is something that was brought forward by The Guardian. And often that means signs over there. The sign language they have developed, it's only they've just done so through their families and their own communities. But that doesn't really translate sort of when they get outside those communities. So that often leaves them unable to participate in society, also leaves them vulnerable to natural disasters. And the government wants to change this and are working to develop a national sign language unique to Vanuatu.
Wow, what an amazing story there. And we've seen really leaps and bounds, particularly around the pandemic when it comes to sign language around the Pacific. We've had some reports here, particularly in Fiji, during the sort of when it was those days where we'd watch the health minister, you know, say the latest COVID numbers, they had someone signing next to them. And I believe it was the first for Fiji, at least, to have someone like that. But obviously, that you need a national sign language to be able to translate some of the local words.
Absolutely.
And so hopefully Vanuatu can join and, see sign language. You know, people sign national addresses as well. That'll be exciting.
Yeah, look, well, they're not too far off, to be honest. And yeah, and to your point, yeah, it is vital. I remember during the pandemic, you'd watch the daily updates. It'd always be somebody, you know, signing on the side of the television. And the good news in relation to this is that it already has received funding. So the Global Partnership for Education and the World Bank have put some funds behind this. And understand it, officials are already travelling around the country collecting signs and gathering data. And once developed, Vanuatu will join Fiji, Kiribati, Samoa and the Solomons as Pacific Island nations with a very own language of their own.
Wow. Do you know any sign language, Kyle?
Me? No. except for some rude words I was taught by a deaf friend I had it in primary school, but I think I remember those ones, but that's about it.
Well, we did have someone from Solomon Islands teaching me some deaf words from there on radio, but it's not the best thing to teach someone on radio, so
that's right.
I'll have to travel there and find myself. Now let's head to French Polynesia, where there's been a fraud case against President Gaston Floss, which has been dismissed. How has the court ruled?
Yeah, a bit of an interesting one. So the magistrate has dismissed an allegation of forgery and fraud, and this is in relation to a property transaction in Paris. So this was reported by Island Business, and this charge was brought against Flossie and his son back in 2018 after investigators accused them of forging management papers for a house they jointly owned with Flossie's former wife. Mm. He produced these papers after the state actually seized that property back in 2011 to ensure he paid back $2 million in public funds, which he spent to the benefit of his own political party, ultimately landing him a suspended prison sentence.
Oh, wow. Okay. So, yes, forgery and buying houses, you know, under potentially distributable means. But I mean, it has been dismissed, so I guess there wasn't enough evidence, or, you know, the allegations didn't stack up, I guess.
Why that was, it didn't actually say in the article, unfortunately, yeah, but you're right, it all does sound quite a little bit messy and probably overly complicated as well.
Indeed.
As court cases usually are.
Well, let's go to something, that might not be as complicated, we'll see. The fixture has been released for next year's Netball World Cup. So how's it shaping up for some Pacific countries?
Yeah, it's shaping up really well, actually. Well, depending on who you ask, maybe not so well for Fiji. I think the odds are going to be a little bit stacked against them in this particular pool. But Tonga and Fiji have both been put in the same pool alongside Australia.
Okay, that might be tricky. Australia are pretty
exactly, good. Yeah. So this is after the netball fixtures for the upcoming World Cup were released. So, yeah, obviously Australia, 11-time world champions, number one in the world. You can pretty much tick them as they're pretty much guaranteed to get through. But in terms of that second team to get through to the knockout stage, I reckon Tonga's probably going to be likely given their meteoric rise in the past 6 months. Fiji might struggle a little bit more, but you never know.
Oh, interesting. And Tonga, didn't they recently win a competition or something? I feel like it's been reported here. I mean, they're quite a competitive team, right?
Oh, they've been fantastic in the last 12 months. Yeah, they went undefeated in the Oceania World Cup qualifiers in Fiji about 6 months ago. They then went undefeated at the Pacific Oz Sports Netball Series in Queensland. Yeah, they've been fantastic, and they've done this all against the backdrop of a volcano eruption, not to mention the pandemic as well. And this is a team that was, you know, that wasn't even ranked 18 months ago, to
really?
Be honest. Yeah. So, you know, the fact that they're number 8 in the world now is,
wow.
It's quite incredible.
That is a meteoric rise. That is amazing. Well, you've just got me interested in netball, Kyle, and I'll be gunning for Team Tonga, I think, and hoping that they can continue this rise.
The Tongatala.
Yes, the Tongatala. Thank you, Kyle, for those stories.
Thanks, Bianca.
That was Kyle Evans bringing us the latest from around the region. And don't go anywhere, though. As always, we've got lots of news and views for you. We'll be speaking to the regional head of the United Nations about what COP27 and the resulting loss and damage fund might mean for the region. Is it all just talk, as often happens with all these climate change conferences, or will we see a real impact when it comes to climate change and that fund? And also, we'll be looking at a new app that claims that it should help labourers in their fruit picking here in Australia. Well, not just the labourers, but also their employers and the farms as well. We'll find out how just coming up.
Join me, Hilda Wayne, for Sisters Let's Talk. I'll be interviewing incredible guests and discussing issues that are in the hearts and minds of Pacific women.
I'd never been in the political scenario. I had never voted until I voted for myself, but I made this crazy decision to stand, so I knew I had to work really, really hard.
So join me, Hilda Wayne, for Sisters Let's Talk, Wednesdays at 3:30 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
And right now, you're joined by me, Priyanka Srinivasan. This is Pacific Beat. Hope you're having a lovely morning. An agreement to establish a loss and damage fund to help developing countries adapt to climate change was a major outcome of the recent COP27 climate summit in Egypt. It came after significant lobbying from Pacific Island countries, who celebrated the agreement as a win. But will this fund actually be successful? It's a question UN Assistant Secretary General and Director of the UNDP Regional Bureau for Asia Pacific, Kani Wignaraj, is asking. She spoke with the ABC's Marion Farr during a visit to Canberra.
Putting this right at the center of the table in COP27 was a win. But establishing as we know is not enough. So the hope is that they will actually be able to resource it. I mean, we've seen, if you recollect, from previous COPs, there's a long delayed promise of $100 billion a year, I think it was, in climate financing that was promised, and that's still waiting in the wings. So while politically it was very good and in very much in the public domain to have a loss and damages fund as part of the final outcome, I can only hope that there is a follow-up to actually put money into this.
And if that fund is established, are you confident that all Pacific Island states, with the exception of Australia and New Zealand, will be beneficiaries, will be able to access this fund?
I don't know. That is something that is yet to be worked out. I think these are the kind of legal and regulatory frameworks that will have to be set up in terms of how and who gets to access these funds. I mean, from a very political and practical realism point of view, one would think that the poorest and most vulnerable countries that are already starting to sink, that those would be at the front of the line should this fund be actualized.
The climate situation in the Pacific is clearly at an urgent stage. Do you think that we can realistically expect this fund to be operational within, say, a year's time? I know that's kind of the framework that's being thrown around. Is that realistic?
You know, I think a big test of this commitment that we heard at COP27 is indeed to see how quickly this fund can get off the ground. The agreement was that 20 plus countries, north and south, will come together in the new year to look at what form this fund should take, who would be contributors to the fund, and how the resources could be distributed. And I think that is going to be the real test. And I hope it doesn't, again, sit in the wings like other promissory notes, so to speak, on climate financing.
Turning to a different security issue, we're seeing a greater geopolitical focus on the Pacific, with China and Australia and the United States devoting more resources and attention to the region. There are fears this could have implications on the security of the islands. Is the United Nations also concerned about security and conflict in the region as a result of this geopolitical interest?
I think for us, I mean, we've always, you know, been working with all of the Pacific Islands in terms of peace building issues. And as you know, throughout the decades now of making sure that certainly internal conflicts and peace agreements, I mean, we've been accompanying these situations for decades. So, you know, there can be no human development without human peace. So, of course, anything that starts to shake issues, whether it's maritime security, whether it's territories, land territory issues, whether it's tribal conflict, all of these issues are deeply concerning. So I do hope that on the larger geopolitical field, that the big players really do put the interests of the Pacific Islands first and foremost, and not their own, in the fact that they are all increasing visibility and presence here.
And do you think that geopolitical contest does put the region at a heightened security risk?
Well, I mean, history has shown that it always does. And so that's where the ability to always have calm spaces to mediate, to negotiate, to come to even uneasy agreements is so important. Because, you know, these tensions, there's always tensions around the world. I mean, I think this is part of the age of the Anthropocene, or the age of humans. There's always these tensions. The issue is always how to keep them in balance and in check, so that those people who have absolutely nothing to do with these tensions, and these are often the poorest, the most marginalized communities, that they don't suffer from the larger issue playing out. So keeping peace in the Pacific certainly is paramount.
That was UN Assistant Secretary General and Director of the UN Development Program Regional Bureau for the Asia and Pacific, Kani Wignaraja, speaking there with reporter Marion Farr. You're listening to Pacific Beat. I'm Priyanka Srinivasan. Hope you're having a lovely Tuesday. It's fruit picking season in Australia, and many Pacific Islanders will be working to get mangoes, bananas, cherries, and other produce to market shelves as part of the Pacific Labour Scheme. But this year, things are a little different with the introduction of a new minimum hourly pay rate, which replaces the piece rate system where workers were paid based on how much they harvest. Hillwood Berries in northern Tasmania is getting on the front foot with a new app specially designed to track productivity, maximise profitability and support workers. Madeline Rojan spoke to General Manager Simon Dornorf about it.
Scan however many trays they have of 250.
One.
Because she's brought back 200-300 grams. I have to say no, she's not finished picking. Go back in. Swap it over to the 300 and scan those ones.
We needed to look at things from a really truly productivity-based approach, whereas before it was anybody could come and pick and you'd have your good pickers at the top and you'd have your lesser skilled pickers at the bottom, and that distribution was quite wide. Now we need to manage that distribution. So once we've done the initial analysis on what our exposure might be with top-ups and how to manage that, we thought about building an app. It's purely an app that we've built that's in-house, that we're able to monitor the workers through the day and how many trays they're picking in terms of kilos per hour, and that allows us to then make decisions whether we need to bring more people into a field, whether we need to performance manage or improve some of the workforce that are struggling to get up to speed, rather than just leave it to a decision at the end of the day.
It's quite known to be a really community type activity, you know. Lots of different people coming to pick the fruit and with friends and other people in their community. And obviously not everyone will now be able to pick to that rate of $25 an hour. Was one of the reasons for creating the app to sort of help upskill those who couldn't pick to that rate but still want to partake in the activity of fruit picking?
We want to pay correctly, and we make sure we pay correctly. So, but with that comes an accountability to the workforce to ensure that we are remaining profitable, or at least break even at times, like public holidays. And you're right, this app is a way for us to give feedback to those workers so they can understand where they sit in the pack and where their shortcomings might be and how we can improve them for them to be able to earn more money to take home and for us to become more productive and efficient and competitive in the market.
Yeah, and how is the new technology? For a lot of people, it can be hard to learn a new piece of technology.
Yeah. Look, we had a whole lot of plans 2 weeks ago when we started that initially it was going to be more of a self-service style, almost like your supermarket checkout, where the worker would come, scan their own trays and keep moving. However, that became quickly apparent that with 400 people, that technology's not necessarily something they're completely used to. We found it quicker and easier to put supervisors into scanning rather than have them, you know, scratching their head trying to figure out how to scan trays in. So we're evolving it as we've launched it in the farm. We're at the very, very start of what we want to achieve. At the moment, it's driven on productivity really by speed, but we understand there's other components to picking that make a good picker. And part of that, we're in a block now picking a premium berry, so we want to build on quality aspects as well, that we can rank pickers on their quality skill too and define other attributes than just speed to what is a makeup of a good picker. Attendance as well is another one, you know, monitoring attendance at work. So we're trying to gather as much information and essentially use data to drive decisions rather than emotion.
And as you said before, we are talking about the only variety that's allowed to be used at Wimbledon, so there's a lot at stake.
Yeah, that's it's a new variety for us. We grow for Driscoll's, and this is a variety that was bred in the UK, and it's the one that Wimbledon, when they have the strawberries and cream, it's a premium variety. That was our first sort of commercial attempt at doing it as a Swedish batch.
What kind of flow-on benefits do you see for your business and for the workers more broadly?
Well, already one of the benefits this week we launched just the other day was we're able to, because we're recording all of their trays live and have got all that access at the end of the day, as soon as we've had a supervisor cast their eye over the day's pick, and we can then, all the pickers have email addresses and the likes, so that sends out a report at the end of the day to each picker to say the number of the trays and what blocks they get, so they can check that every day to see that they are, that is what we have. And also at the start of every day, when the picker clocks in for their start time, we also display to the picker what the piece rate is for the day, because that's part of the award. They need to be shown exactly what the piece rate will be. And then when they accept to start work, that also emails them a record of what the piece rate is for the blocks they're doing. So they're getting all the information every day now. So that worker feels like they're getting all the pieces of the puzzle to understand what their pay is going to be.
And Simon, it's been pretty temperamental weather. We've had really hot sunny days, then, you know, it started raining, humidity, it's actually snowing some places today in Tasmania. How's the season looking?
Yeah, it's been a headache, to say the least. In our raspberries, we're in the middle of our flowering, and last week's beautiful hot weather brought on a lot of flowering, and then to come back into gloomy overcast days reduces bee activity that helps pollinate our raspberries. And one of those the bees do is take the nectar out of the flower so the flower can ripen into a berry. But if you get gloomy overcast cool weather, the bee activity is a lot lower. So we're having to send a tractor through with a fan on the back of it, blowing the nectar out of the flowers daily, just to ensure that our crop is going to meet its potential, and that will have some flow-on effects for pollination, but not anywhere near what a bee could do. But that's just to protect that crop, because, again, we have 400 workers lined up. If we lose half of it because of poor pollination, we then have to job create somewhere else for these workers that we've got a responsibility for. So I guess we're taking extreme measures this year more than ever. It is incredibly testing, and, you know, of the three seasons of La Nina, this has definitely been the toughest seasons to date, with how it's dragged on.
Yeah, fans on tractors and new apps for productivity. Challenging times call for innovation, don't they?
Extreme measures, yeah. Yeah, it does. It does.
That was Hillwood Berries GM, General Manager Simon Dornoff, speaking there about their new fruit picking app to Madeline Rojan. And of course, that is the farmer's point of view. That is the point of view of a general manager of a berry farm here in Australia. But of course, there are a lot of workers involved, and a lot of Pacific Island workers, workers as well on these farms. So if you know anyone who works on Australian farms, what do you think about a possible app that might make increased productivity and claims also ensure workers are getting paid what they need to? Is this really the way forward? Can it indeed help some of those concerns around payment that we hear from farms? Or are there other solutions that could be considered? Do get in touch. You can reach us on ABC Pacific on Facebook and Twitter. You can also email us at pacific@abc.net.au. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. And with that, we're at the end of Pacific Beat. Thank you so much for your company this morning. If you did miss out on any of the stories, well, you can catch up, of course. You can find us online. But as a reminder, we looked at a Papua New Guinea's population after a new study that suggested the population could be 2 times higher than previously thought. But there is some concern that the study isn't quite accurate. Do stick around, though. We've got news next. You can also tune in to another version of Pacific Beat later this evening.